It is now my great pleasure to introduce a colleague of mine at the Aspen Institute, Steve Grand, who is the director of our Middle East Strategy Group.
Hello and welcome. As you can tell, we have a very distinguished panel for today's plenary session on the changing Middle East, and it could not come at a more appropriate time as the region is buffeted by many, many different forces of change. It's my great pleasure at this point to introduce Dov Zakheim, the moderator of today's session. Dov is a vice president at Booz Allen Hamilton, one of the corporate partners for this event. He was formerly the Undersecretary of Defense, the Comptroller, with responsibility for the Pentagon's vast budget. He was also the DoD's coordinator of civilian programs in Afghanistan and the principal international fundraiser for Iraqi reconstruction. Dov, thank you.
Well, thanks very much. This crowd proves that Kim Il-sung doesn't have everybody's, or rather Kim Jong-il doesn't have everybody's attention this morning. Although the person to my right, I think, was kept up pretty much all night commenting on it. We do have a distinguished panel. You probably know every one of them, and the introductions are probably unnecessary, so I'm going to fly through those. And I want to lay out a ground rule now so you can think about it later. In order to get as many questions in as possible, because everybody here, I am sure, has at least one, we're going to take three questions at a time. There are two mics here, so line up, and we'll try as best we can to answer as many as we can and at the same time get some points across about the subject. To my immediate right, Secretary Madeleine Albright. If you didn't see her on television, you probably still know she was Secretary of State. She is very much involved in policy and international matters still, leading figure on the National Democratic Institute, professor both at the School of Foreign Service in Georgetown and the University of Michigan Business School, or is that
done?
So it's only one professorship now, sorry about that. Author of a book that I understand the Almighty is reading, as well as the Mighty. Moving along to a very good friend of mine, Ambassador Nabil Fahmy, who has a long and distinguished career in the Egyptian Foreign Service, advisor to several foreign ministers, one of the shrewdest, most capable professionals in the region, and himself a scion of a very distinguished family. To the right of him, another career diplomat, Ambassador Danny Ayalon of Israel, who had some very senior posts in the Israeli Foreign Ministry and has been here now 4 years, is it? And to the right of Ambassador Ayalon, Her Majesty Queen Noor, who is now, I think, safe to say, one of the leading activists in the region. Heads the King Hussein Foundation, supports all kinds of activities that involve bringing peace, security, and progress in the region, on a host of issues, many of which we're going to be discussing momentarily. And finally, Ambassador Karim Kawar, not a career diplomat, a very prominent career businessman and with special expertise in information technology, who is now the ambassador of Jordan and brings, therefore, a somewhat different perspective from those of us who have been in policy only. This is a huge subject, and we could spend an hour just discussing what we mean by the Middle East. We're not going to do that. There are, in many ways, about a half a dozen major drivers in what you might call global dynamics, which is the overarching subject of this group of meetings. And some of them, in fact, just about all of them, are especially salient in the Middle East. Let's take demographics. Okay, probably thinking about Gaza right now and Iraq and warfare and so on, but just demographics. At a minimum, you have 35% of this region under the age of 15. Depends which estimate you want to have. Some people say 40%. Some people say 45%. In the Gulf, 70% of the population are under the age of 30. Now, if somebody with four kids under the age of 30, that is scary. Governance and democracy, not always the same words. Major issues in every country in the region. Environmental issues. 50% of this region doesn't have enough water. Economic issues. Countries that have total reliance on oil. Other countries that have none. 20% unemployment and export of people across the Mediterranean into Europe with all the social ramifications that entail. And yet at the same time, lots of investment in IT in the region. The third largest magnet for investment after China and India. So this is a region of contrast, complexity, and when you take the American perspective, you look at how we have tried in the United States. Is that mine?
Yes.
Hello, Secretary Albright. Well, I guess she's here. I don't have to talk to you. When you look at the United States and what it's tried to do, it's tried to play in governance. So many people will say that's what Iraq is about. It's tried to affect many of the other dynamics in the region. That's what the Middle East Partnership Initiative is about. Women's issues, youth issues, economic issues. And of course, it's tried to help make peace in the Middle East between the Arabs and Israelis, and not just between Arabs and Israelis. So the question, and I'm going to throw this out first to Queen Noor, what more should we be doing? And not only that, what should the region be doing?
Well, that's a huge question. And I think that we'll be discussing a range of responses to that. We is who?
We is the United States. You is the region, or you can be who you want to be. You're a queen.
I am. I do consider myself a citizen of the world. And by the way, I am the only really non-official person here except for you, sir. So I wouldn't want to state that up front. I think that the United States has played both very positive and problematic roles in the region. Traditionally, it has been viewed as a beacon of values, democratic values, of achievements in terms of education, science, and technology, reflecting many of the aspirations of the people in the region over generations for open democratic participatory societies, and to, you know, the aspirations to want to participate in to take advantage of the science and technology and accomplishments in the larger world that the Arab world has lagged behind considerably in. Politically, the role of the United States has often been compromised by, or has compromised the respect for and identification with those values I just mentioned. There have been positive moments, and there have been many confusing and disturbing moments. We are at a period of incredible lows. Madeline will talk about poll numbers, I think, that indicate that there is a great deal of mutual fear and distrust between our worlds. I would simply like to mention a period that two leaders and a period that I think reflected many of the possibilities that we need to explore and further develop in the region, and can, because that was a period of hope and promise. It was a period, it's mid-1990s, when you had political will in the United States, which was playing a very active, both overtly and in terms of a nurturing role, investing leadership, investing political capital, taking risks to support leaders in the region who also shared a political vision for a region living in peace, for negotiations based on mutual respect and the principle of respecting each other's needs for justice and for security, recognizing that no party in the region will ever know any security and peace if all are not able to enjoy those opportunities. I'm speaking in particular of King Hussein, who was one of several Arabs at that time working actively with the government of Yitzhak Rabin. Yitzhak Rabin had been a military man for 27 years, and he'd come to see that the conventional defensive security mindset that resorted to often to violence and to suppression as means of controlling problems among the Palestinians living in the occupied territories and with the other Arab states was not working. It wasn't going anywhere. It was promising no hope, no possibility for future generations. King Hussein, of course, shared that vision, as did others who, in a time where there was this atmosphere of mutual respect, of looking for partners, even among the enemy, there was a sense of glimmering hope and possibility. And that was translated down to individuals and organizations, public and private, who were reaching out during this period of the peace process operating on the Palestinian-Israeli track, the Jordan-Israeli track, the Egyptian treaty in place, the United States, as I said, investing its own political capital. You had the broad swath of society also beginning to explore how we might work to address cooperatively environmental problems, science and technology problems, education issues, industry that could benefit from cooperative rather than isolated development. So it was a period in which there was, as I said, hope and possibility because there was political will, there was vision, there was a sense of our common future. And I would like to say that I think that the United States, you know, that the role it played during that time was very positive, very valuable. I think we need to see the United States engage once again, promote this concept of mutual respect, of negotiations based on mutual respect, on a cooperative spirit, on holding all sides equally accountable, as we must do ourselves, to our obligations to a peace process.
Well, Madeline, you were there. You were the Secretary of State. And how would you look to the future, and not just with respect to the Arab-Israeli crisis, but as Queen Nur said, across the board, where do we need to go? And also, what would you like to see the region do?
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for being on this panel. I'm very glad to participate with everybody here. Before I do that, I'd like to just set one particular context. President Clinton assigned us various books to read, and he told me that I should read a book called The Peace to End All Peace, which was written by David Fromkin and describes the creation of the modern Middle East, and basically after the First World War. The short version of the book is that the modern Middle East was created because the British and French bureaucracies were lying to each other. Many of the countries in the modern Middle East are artificial, Iraq being the prime example of an artificial country. I have spent a lot of time on the issue, and as Queen Noor pointed out, I think that the Clinton administration really did spend probably more time on the Israeli-Palestinian issue than on anything else, with the president deeply involved. I was involved, and then Dennis Ross and a whole peace team was involved, so it was a prime activity. I think we probably made some mistakes, but we definitely were deeply involved. I was recently in Dubai, and I went to a women's university there, and I was very interested in that all the women were fully clothed in black, and it was the most feminist audience I've dealt with in a long time. And one young woman, and I did my kind of standard thing about the Middle East being the most dangerous place in the world, and did my kind of perfect storm description of what was going on. And she gets up and she says, you know, it wasn't dangerous until you all got here, which set me back a little bit, because I think that the question really is, basically what is the role of the outside as far as some of the issues in the Middle East are concerned. Dov talked about democracy. I am chairman of the board of the National Democratic Institute. That's an organization that's been in place for 20 years. And we don't impose democracy. We go around the world trying to help countries that are interested in democratic systems to have the nuts and bolts of democracy. And I think that we have in many ways been unclear about whether we believe everybody wants to have democracies. I happen to believe that we're all the same and that everybody everywhere wants to be able to make decisions about how he or she runs their own lives. And it begins with wanting to figure out where you go to school or how who you elect municipally and moves up the line. So I very much don't feel that the expressions of democracy are a purely American activity. There are other kinds of democracies than American democracy. And I think that it is important to understand that many of the Muslim countries, all of them, in some way or another, do not think that that democracy is inimical to their religion. This Pew poll was mentioned, and there's some out there that you can all look at. The most recent one was done in May in 14 countries, and it is very interesting because of the very many aspects in there. It says that more Muslims believe that they can operate with democratic governments than Western governments think that Muslims can operate with democratic governments. I think that the issue that comes up often is that what happens in free elections and why people are afraid of them is the wrong people get elected. We know that. And I think that one...
To quote Jack Benny, well.
But I think that we have to understand the process of democracy. So I do think that it is very important for us to understand it. Not, and as a part of a Council on Foreign Relations group, we went to the region, and I think the thing that we advocated, not that the U.S. imposed democracy, but that the U.S. support democracy in the places where it is moving forward. I also think that it's very important for us to understand the economic issues. Dov mentioned the young, the youth bulge that is really evident throughout the Middle East, and I just want to tell one story, and then because I think it illustrates this. Steve is running something that both Queen Noor and I are part of, the Middle East Strategy Group. And we really began this in a very big way last summer here. And we began to talk about a variety of projects that Israeli and Palestinian business people were going to do in Gaza. The unilateral withdrawal had taken place, and we knew that a lot of businesses had to take place. And it was a fabulous way to really create industries that would employ a lot of people. That was the whole point of it. And we had four things that we were working on. One was a cut-and-sew operation to employ a lot of women in the textile business. The other was to build apartment houses, which would clearly employ a lot of people in construction, a hospital, and a power plant. And we had a number of meetings, and in fact, we're also involved in purchasing the greenhouses. Now, the problem in the Middle East is that you never know where the problem began. You can go back to Genesis or before. And there's always somebody saying, well, they started it or we started it. And so I think that's the problem. The bottom line at the moment is those projects are on total hold. And if you are reading about some Palestinian business people are leaving, and this we have continue to have support from the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, OPIC, for loans, so that the United States wants to be involved in supporting. But we have to be careful now, and I think it's the real story, that we have to create businesses so that there is employment, so that there's not despair, so that people then don't turn to other methods. So I believe the U.S. does need to be involved. I think that we can't have kind of flybys in terms of our diplomacy, but we have to listen to what's happening in the region.
Nabil?
First, let me congratulate you on the 4th of July. And I'm trying to play to the audience, but honestly, I attended the discussion yesterday on democracy in America. Four or five Americans and one Frenchman. And there was more criticism from the American side than from the Frenchman. And you should be proud of that. the essence of what you need to export to the region to help us do is not whether you have this kind of voting system or the other, whether you have a parliamentary democracy or a republic or the sorts. It's the desire to continuously be self-critical and try to get the system better. Democracy is a messy business, but as is often said, it's the best one out there for the time being. So I'm happy to learn from America, not from the details, but from the desire to actually look at the system and make it better. Now let me move to some of the issues in the Middle East, and because they all relate to each other. I agree with Dov and with Secretary Albright that the most challenging and critical issue in years to come will be job creation in the Middle East. 56% of my country's population, and we're one out of every four Middle Easterners, so you're going to see us around for a while, is 25 or younger, and they want jobs. That is what we need to do. Now, we've been very successful economically over the last couple of years, growing at 6% approximately, and as Doug was saying, in the ICT sector in particular, 16%. So there's potential and movement there. But the reality is, to really create 700,000 new jobs every year in Egypt and 100 million jobs over the next 20 years in the Middle East, you need to deal with several issues. We need to really engage on the democracy issue, not manage democracy, but manage transformation, so we don't lead to chaos. I'm not calling for managing democracy, but if you don't have a managed transformation where people feel you have, there are more stakeholders, you ultimately lose potential in terms of investment and so on and so forth. And frankly, no matter how hard we try, and I'm glad Queen Noor raised this issue, as did Secretary Albright, we were there in the 90s. We talked about the multilaterals. We talked about environmental projects, economic projects, about industrial zones. I was in the midst of this with my Israeli colleagues in the Gaza-Rafah area, and it all broke down. It broke down not because we didn't think of it before. It broke down because we couldn't solve the political issues, the regional issues, the Arab-Israeli conflict in particular, and with particular emphasis on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. So that is, I believe, an issue of paramount importance to deal with as we deal with the other issues. It's not correct, nor is it feasible anymore in an open, transparent society to say we will deal with this issue first and only when we finish we can deal with the other issues. Iraq also is a problem, frankly. No matter where your position was at the start of this issue, if we end up with sectarian politics in the Middle East and ethnic politics, it's going to be a nightmare for us when you come back to Arlington. And it's one that's going to affect our future for years to come, and ultimately yours as well. So we will work with you, and I'm sure all the other countries in the region will work with you to try to end up with a unified Iraq for all Iraqis. But I just want to raise a point of caution. Ethnic politics is not the direction we want to go. And I've read the same book, and I've agonized over how things started and how things didn't start. I didn't refer to it because Arabs are always accused of blaming it on somebody else, so I didn't want to blame it on the colonial powers. But the reality is, with Anwar Sadat in 71, 72, 73, and then again when he went to visit Jerusalem, he was turning a new page. He was basically saying, let's just start solving this from where we are now, building on what the Security Council had decided in 68. What we're trying to do is, let's solve today's problems, not score results of who was where and who did what in the past. And I completely agree with Queen Noor. There are no unilateral answers. There's no win for one side. Security for the Arab side is providing security for Israel. Security for Israel is providing security for the Arab side. And our future is going to be interdependent for many, many years to come.
Dan, how would you respond to that?
Well, first of all, I would like to thank the Aspen Institute for inviting me to this August panel, and for all of you for being here. It's a great opportunity. Let me preface my remarks by quoting one of the great panelists here, Secretary Albright, I believe, who said that the United States is the indispensable country, certainly in the 20th, 21st century. And it certainly is indispensable in the Middle East. I think it's looked up as a great, benevolent power. I think it's because of its strength, strategic strength, economic, political, but also its moral strength. And let me continue where Nabil left off. Part of the respect you command is this self-criticism that you describe on the panel of the 4th of July. This is what we sorely lack in the region, is self-criticism, is pluralism of thoughts, and openness. And I think what it all ties down to, we need a better system of education there, which would ultimately change fundamentally the political structure. Without a stable political structure, which would be along the democratic model of the West, although I think it's politically incorrect to come to the region and say, we want to democratize you. I think it's more important to talk about modernity in the region. So women will have equal rights. So all people will have equal opportunities, especially in the economic fields. And also to have more pluralistic thoughts and less fundamental thoughts. And here, I think it's incumbent upon leaders, political leaders in the region, but also clergy, to disassociate with fanaticism, with radicalism, and also with downright terrorism, which is really the main source of problems that we see of instability. I do not think that the main problem in the region necessarily is the Palestinian-Israeli thing. It's certainly a major factor for security for the entire region, but it's not the only one, and certainly it doesn't deserve all this extreme attention that we have been given to it on the expense, I think, of Darfur, of what's happening in Africa, whether it was in Rwanda, in Bosnia, or any other places. When we look at the region, when you see one country like Iraq evading Kuwait in 1990, or you see Syria engulfing Lebanon in 1976, and there are many other disputes, and I don't want to go to the 60s. I think Egypt was involved in Yemen there. So certainly, the Israeli-Palestinian aspect is only one of many, although it's a serious one, but there are many other serious problems. And I do think, directly to answer your question, what the United States should do is just continue the path. And this is what is the most important, to communicate to the people your commitment to continue what you have started. Because there are many players in the region who are still apprehensive that the U.S. will start, live in the middle, and leave everybody to the wrath of the extremists. So what I think the U.S. should do, and again, irrespective of what anybody thinks here about the Iraq war, is to finish Iraq in a way which would stabilize Iraq, which would lend to economic developments there, to contain Iran, which is very, very important, and also to help all the countries to combat terrorism. Unfortunately, we have a situation where we have two countries there, Iran and Damascus, and if you look at every boiling pot in the region, you see the fingerprints either of Damascus or Iran. You see it in Iraq, you see it in Lebanon, you see it in the territories. Every time we come to some kind of a turning point and trying to move and progress politically, there is a spate of or increase of terrorism, which is motivated and financed and ordered from Damascus or Tehran through proxies like Hamas or Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, and many others. So I think it is very important for the U.S. to continue that and to make sure that the people there, that the leaders understand that the U.S. is there to stay, not as a colonialist power, but as somebody to, as a power, a benevolent power, to help the region financially, socially, economically. I think it was a brave Arab academics in 2000 who talked about the deficit of freedom in the region. This is what should be introduced. And it shouldn't be introduced as a forced element, but something which would be homegrown. But the U.S. and the entire community has a lot to do with that. But mainly, we are there to stay until all of you respect each other, until all of you become pluralistic with open markets and really creating a middle class, which is sorely missed in the region. Only with the creation of middle class, I think we can help education in a sustainable way, economic growth in a sustainable way, and that would lead, hopefully, to a much more peaceful atmosphere which could then hopefully solve the political problems which exist today.
Karim. But as a businessman and as a diplomat and in a country where a lot of change has been directed from the top down as opposed to the bottom up, how do you feel about all this stuff about the United States doing this and the United States doing that? And in terms of the progress you've seen, where do you need to go next?
Thanks, Dov. As an entrepreneur, I was minding my own business 4 years ago. Certainly when I look at the region, I'm someone who always looks at the opportunity. And unfortunately, we have seen many missed opportunities in our part of the world. But certainly when we look at the United States' role, but also at the youth bulge, we need to see with those challenges what are the opportunities that lie within. As far as reforms in the region, I believe that, one, there has to be ownership. Ownership has to come from within the region. Reform cannot be imposed, whether it's democracy, whether it's education. It has to be a homegrown crop so that the people who want to embark on this change feel that this is something their own and it's not something that's being imposed from the outside. Two, I believe it's leadership. That change cannot happen unless somebody takes the leading position in getting the people to follow. In Jordan, this has been very much a top-down approach. His Majesty King Abdullah who's sometimes given the title the CEO of Jordan Inc., has taken that approach of saying, let's start with change from the top. Let's bring in the prime minister and the cabinet. Let's try to instill change through our parliament. At the same time, growing the grassroots. So our investment in education. We are a country that lacks natural resources. We don't have the oil wealth that the rest of the region enjoys. So our education system had to be upgraded. We're now teaching English and computer literacy starting from grade one in all public schools. And we boast the highest literacy rate in the region. And the third issue is partnership, that we cannot embark on those reforms without the help of the countries that want to help, first and foremost the United States, but all the other donor countries and organizations that have contributed. We do not enjoy the luxury of time. We cannot wait for ages. One of the models for us has been Ireland in specific, and Singapore and other smaller countries where we have drawn on those examples, localized that experience into a Jordanian model that we have been instructed by His Majesty to share with our neighbors. So things are heading in the right direction. I believe the United States, by continuing to consult with the stakeholders, and we consider ourselves as major stakeholders in the peace process and in the stability of the whole region, we believe working closely with the United States in directing that energy to have greater results would be a major positive force for the region as a whole.
Madeline, I know you wanted to say something.
Well, I do think if one looks at the region right now, and I would like to think about it as a region, things could not be worse. Therefore, I think we should take the Leninist approach, which is the worse the better, and think a little bit about the future and how we can really see that having the whole region fall into turmoil is a disaster for the region and for everybody else. And so I would like to push us forward a little bit, continuing with the Marxist theme here. Democracy has to deliver. People prefer to eat than to vote. And so I think that we do have to figure out a way to have the economies in the countries work. And I would love to see us begin to talk about a regional framework, a regional economy, because some of the things that were beginning to happen, for instance, the qualified industrial zones or free trade areas and various aspects, I think those need to be out there as hope. The other thing in terms of Danny was talking about the U.S. should stay. I think the U.S. should stay, but we have to make very clear, not with permanent military bases. We cannot be there as occupying power within the whole region. And in order to get security, which is clearly the most problematic issue, I think we need to begin to think about the Middle East as a region that should be part, have its own security framework. The issues are how, whether you want to begin with Israel or whether you want to begin with other parts. I do think that one of Iran's problems is that it actually has won the war in Iraq, but I think that the bottom line is it needs to be within some kind of a security framework in order to have some sense of control over the whole aspect. Then I also, we were talking about resources. There need to be common electric grids. You were talking about the problems with water. And rather than focusing just on one part of this issue and to really move us forward, I think we need to think about it more as a region where the U.S. is supportive, as would Europe be and others who want to see the place, the whole area operate. And at the same time, the countries in the region would have to see themselves as partners and not as enemies.
Well, Nabil, Egypt's been a regional leader forever. How do you respond to that? It hasn't happened. And this isn't particularly new either, as you know. People have talked about regional grids. We've talked about that for ages. What do we do?
There are two issues here, really. One which is not Arab-Israeli, and the other that is Arab-Israeli. Inter-Arab trade is, and Karim, if I'm wrong, correct me here, the last time I looked at it was 6 to 7% of Arab trade with the rest of the world. And it had nothing to do with Arab-Israeli politics. The reality is the economies of most of the Arab world are a function of a relationship with the developed world in most cases. And we can go back to your book and explain why, or some mistakes we have done as well. So there is an economic problem here that if you talk to the investor, he will not put his money in Cairo before putting it in Paris because he makes more money out of Paris. And we therefore need to develop the economies of the region before we can expect any real, significant, substantial cooperation, even among the Arab countries, only on economic terms. The Arab-Israeli conflict is a reality. We went through this process in 1991, 92, to the late 90s, and it was all done in good faith, trying to build up these common interests. And I would do it again if I had to do it again. But we failed because the momentum of the peace process wasn't followed by, wasn't ahead of the momentum of creating a common tangible interest. In terms of what the U.S. has to do, and again, I prided you in your self-criticism, and I think I owe you to be candid. There's not a single Arab-Israeli agreement that came to closure without the U.S. being there. Arabs and Israelis have never been able to bring agreements to closure. I come from a country where let's start the peace process. Anwar Sadat started the peace process. Nobody else believed it was possible. But we couldn't bring it to closure had not President Carter invited Sadat and Begin to Camp David and done the same thing. The same applies to the Jordanian-Israeli agreement, the Oslo process, and so on and so forth. But you're not very good at reading trends in the region. We always read them before you. And I can give you a historical record of that. I just don't want to because it appears to be I'm blowing our own horn here. But the reality is it is natural that people living in the region will sense the trends before people living outside the region, especially that you as a global power have many different interests. Today it's North Korea. So when we knock on your door and say there's a problem in this part of the Middle East, you say, well, there are 7 missiles that have been tested in North Korea. So we shouldn't expect you to always read those trends before we do. But I urge you to listen. Because in all honesty, you're not listening to people in the Middle East. That's the basic reason why you're not reading the trends. You're not listening to the people in the Middle East. And occasionally when things go wrong, you then go out and criticize those who've been trying to help you from the beginning. Well, you surprise us. We didn't surprise you. We've been saying these issues. We've been saying that military conflict in the region would lead to anti-Americanism. And I can quote American, Egyptian presidents and Jordanian kings saying that over and over again. But you are busy with being you were busy with being one of the two superpowers of the world. Now you're the only global power. So if Egypt has a responsibility, being 7,000 years old, of being a leader in the Middle East, and I take that responsibility, including the criticism, you have a responsibility as the only real global power to try to understand regional and sub-regional problems. The problem I see when I travel around America is you can't find the enemy, and therefore you can't develop a constituency domestically to address a major problem. I have said openly, I would like to see Egyptians sit down and criticize our political system, including the government, in a positive sense, as I saw yesterday here in America. The problem, however, is if you don't look out to the world and watch actually what's happening around the world, as the global power, you will pay a much larger price because you will be surprised by these sub-regional and regional problems. You have the best foreign policy community in the world and the weakest foreign policy constituency for any major power in the world.
Well, thanks so much for that compliment. Can folks who want to ask questions start coming up to the mics, and as while you're doing that, in the interest of efficiency, I'd like to turn to Queen Noor. You kicked this off. You've heard a lot of different points of view. Do you buy into, say, what Nabil just said?
I do believe that that we have, well, actually, just talking about self-criticism, we have now, for the first time over the last 3 or 4 years, a UNDP report issued, written and published by Arab former political members, thinkers, intellectuals, academics, etc. They're called the Arab Human Development Reports. Three have been issued, a fourth is on the way. They highlighted for the first time ever an Arab concerns. These are credible Arab authors about the various challenges faced in the region that have been holding the region's development and progress back, focusing specifically on knowledge and education, on freedoms, and on the role of women. These have sparked a new debate, social and political discourse, that is having an impact on governments, is having an impact on both the private and the public sector, is probably one of the most interesting and important developments to have taken place for a very long time. It is critical self-analysis. It is very, they have been very direct and frank. They've been criticized by various governments within the Arab world, as well as the United States has brought pressure on the process and others. But they have had the courage to talk about what needs to be discussed. And within the context of those reports, there is mention of the role of the United States, various political issues in the region, and what I believe is a heart of our a heart of the problem with our relationship with the United States, as well as with the ability to the Arab-Israeli conflict. I have to come back to it. I don't believe that you can develop structures in the region and make considerable progress on all these different areas of development and hope that that is going to solve the Arab-Israeli conflict, the Palestinian. And we see today what is taking place over the last several days. We see the violent act responded to with another violent act, and a process, a vicious cycle in place that is having a deleterious effect throughout the region. And I think you have to recognize this is the longest military occupation in modern history. This is not comparable to some of the other examples that I think were mentioned by the ambassador. There are UN Security Council resolutions on the occupation of Arab and Palestinian land. Those have to be approached with the same commitment and conviction that other UN Security Council resolutions on the occupation of Kuwait or in other other dilemmas in the region have been approached with the same political will, the same commitment. I think it's absolutely vital for us to make progress in this in these other areas. We cannot wait. We have to simultaneously commit to resolving these, the Iraqi problem, but the Arab-Israeli conflict and the developmental problems that are raised in the Arab Human Development Report.
Okay, I see. My guess is that Dan wants to respond, but if you'll indulge me, I guess you'll be able to do that in the course of the Q&A. I see four people standing. So why don't we take all four questions. Just tell us to whom you're directing your comment, or maybe to everybody, and actually tell us who you are. That'd be kind of neat.
My name is Bob Kleinman. I'm directing this question to the entire panel. I compliment you on giving us some idea of the changing Middle East. But here we are dealing with less than half the countries in the Middle East. We're missing Syria. We're missing Lebanon. We're missing Saudi Arabia. We're missing Iran, we're missing Palestine, and we're particularly missing Iraq, so because I don't understand why, if they're so close to us, they're not up there explaining their problems. And I hope that if we do this in another year, that all of you up there who have contacts with these countries will try to induce them to come here, because I'd like to hear the other side. I hear, think we're all talking to one another up there. I'm sorry to say that, but that's what I feel.
Okay. We're talking all to on the same side.
I'm Mort Kondracki, a journalist. I detect in this entire festival a deep pessimism about U.S. involvement in Iraq. But I'd like to have you, the panel, envision what would happen if there were success in Iraq. And by success, I mean a stable semi-democracy there, which was representative of its people, security forces that could control the insurgency and represent the people as well. And I would ask you, what would be the consequence of success for the region, that is to say, for the development of democracy elsewhere, for the control of Iran and al-Qaeda and terrorism in the region? Would success in Iraq, in other words, lead to good results in the region? And as a follow-up, I would suggest that
if
you think that success would lead to good results in the region, what are you each not doing that you could do to produce success in Iraq?
Okay, over to that side.
Okay, Ambassador Yellen. You spoke a little about Iran and Syria and the need for the U.S. to contain Iran. And I was wondering what our panel thought about the involvement of Iran and Syria in the region and what both the U.S. and the Middle East can be doing about that.
Okay.
I'm Jane Harmon, proud to be a member of the Aspen Middle East Strategy Group, which is really a great project, and I hope it does move forward soon. At any rate, only Danny talked about the need to confront terrorism. I didn't hear anyone else mention it. And yet in some of your countries, for example, Egypt, there is an enormous rise of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a great threat to Egypt, let alone the region. I'm aware Karim didn't mention it, but His Majesty King Abdullah held a meeting of clergy in the region to encourage the moderates to speak out against the radicals. And so my question is, isn't terrorism a big issue in all of your countries? And if so, what are some strategies to deal with it in your own countries? And they may obviously have spillover to Israel's, by my view, noble efforts to deal with terrorism in Israel.
Thanks. Why don't we get two folks to address each of these questions? So who wants to deal with the question of hearing the other folks, Syria, Iran, getting them here, and so on? Anybody in the audience have an answer?
I'm always happy to talk about Syria and Iran. Nobody else volunteers.
But it's getting them up here.
Getting them up here, yes. I think that's pretty much depicts the sorry situation we are in the region, of not having all members of the region here. I'm not sure that the Saudi ambassador would come here knowing that I am here. He wouldn't share the platform with me. And that goes for many, many other countries. So this is also a deep problem. I truly believe what Secretary Albright said is very important. I mean, to bring this region together through a grid of electricity, water development, economic activity, the QIZs worked tremendously well on the case of Jordan, and now, since, you know, before the QIZ, I don't know if all of you are aware of that, but the QIZ was using Israel free trade agreement with the United States to promote Jordanian trade with the United States. Before the QIZ, I believe, Karim, correct me if I'm wrong, the bilateral trade between Jordan and the United States was like $60 million a year. Now it's over $1 billion. This model was so successful and also helped cooperation, industrial cooperation between Israeli companies and Jordanian companies. This model was so successful that now it's being emulated with Egypt. I hope this could be also done in many, many other countries. But to do that, Madeleine, we need the political will to do it. I'll give you two examples. And the issue of water. Back in 1994, realizing that we have an ever-decreasing supply of fresh water in the region and ever-increasing demand because of the demography, Israel initiated, also with the help of the international community and the World Bank, a regional project to create big water plants, desalination plants. Now, you have to understand that desalination plant, like power plants, takes a lot of money. It's a billions of dollars of cash outlay before you see one drop of fresh water. This is why it's so difficult for any country to assume upon itself. So it makes sense for economy of scale to do it on a regional basis. We tried to interest many, many countries in the region. It was a great interest, but then there wasn't the political will to do it. We were left with the dilemma, are we going alone or not? We decided to go alone, and this is what we will continue to do. I hope that other countries will join us, and the same would be with electric grid and transportation grid and what have you. Another example,
Dan, I'm going to be rude and cut you off. I've got three more questions, three more questioners. So let's, if you don't mind, and
go
forgive
on.
Me, who would like to take the question about what if we succeeded in Iraq?
Well, we are the ones who say we cannot afford the failure in Iraq. So we have to do everything we can to help. We have been trying also not to meddle in Iraq's internal affairs, which the other countries, and primarily Iran and Syria, have not done too well. I believe we need to also put things into the right context. To believe that Iraq is going to have a democracy overnight was the wrong promotion. We needed to have managed our expectations better, because still Iraq lacks the structures of democracy, and that's what will take some time. So to expect that Iraq will have a democracy that we should not be just measured by elections, that remains to be a challenge. Iraq still has to manage its own stability inside to fight the insurgency. And that will take some time. But certainly, I believe it will be a positive change. But that is not to say that the rest of the countries, the rest of the region, is not moving forward, and we are only waiting for Iraq to set that example or that model. I think that would be a wrong presumption, because certainly there is no cookie-cutter approach for democracy in the region, and definitely it should not be measured merely by elections.
Okay, the next question was specifically not to Ambassador Ayalon, because he had mentioned Iran and Syria. Who else on the panel wants to talk about their impact in what's going on right now and what to do about it? Yeah.
I'm not going to discuss my impact because I don't represent,
No, I didn't mean they're yours.
Yeah, I know exactly
Iran
what
Syria.
You mean, and that's why I wanted. I think that one of the problems, and this ties in with the issue of terrorism, extremism, in the region is that the conventional wisdom in the Arab world for over a long period of time has been that discouraging or preventing political party development and political reform would weaken Islamists and radicals in the region. And what has happened is the opposite, as it so often does. When you don't bring all stakeholders to the table, when you don't provide political space for all points of view, that inevitably will provide the greatest strength to moderates, the moderate mainstream. Instead, the Islamists and radicals have gone underground and have played on the sense of injustice and marginalization that is only normal. And the more moderate and, you know, possibly, you know, secular liberal parties who could have provided alternatives, who could have played a key role in political discourse, were all but shut down and had no avenues. So I think when you're talking about terrorism, when you're talking about development, and you're talking about the youth and what they are seeing as they're coming up, this is one of the most critical challenges that we face.
Madeline, do you want to address Iran and Syria and terrorism?
I think I have kind of a general theory, which is that not talking to countries doesn't get you anywhere. And that while you might disagree, and it is not a sign, it's not a gift of any kind. So I spent a lot of time actually talking to the Syrians, and we tried, in some effect, to change our relationship with Iran. So I actually would welcome having Syrian and Iranian people here to talk about it. And I do think that we gain, and we were talking about Kim Jong-il. I feel the same way about the North Koreans. I think we have to talk to people. We don't get anywhere with that. I think the issue on terrorism is that the truth is that we don't really know what all the elements are that create terrorists. I mean, obviously, poverty is one of them, lack of dignity, lack of inclusiveness, all those particular issues. And they are all evident in the Middle East in some form or another. And I think that we will not be able to address it if we don't look at the various economic issues. And Congresswoman Harman mentioned about religion and what King Abdullah is doing. That's a little plug for my book. One of the things that I've been talking about is the necessity of bringing religious leaders into political discussions. They are playing more and more of a role. I am not advocating that religious leaders sit at the negotiating table, but they are capable of breaking the problem down. They are capable of being resources during the negotiations, and then perhaps most important, they can be validators once the decisions have been made. And I think the more that we can do to seek common ground through religious leaders and for religion to be used as a way to bring people together rather than what has been happening now, which is everybody saying that God is on their side when we know that God is on everybody's side.
Okay, very, very quickly. 1, 2, 3, 4, because I'm in injury time now and somebody's going to injure me.
Hi, I'm Rachel Kleinfeld. I run the Truman National Security Project, which is a big D democratic national security organization. And first of all, I wanted to thank you all. I've lived in Nazareth, Jerusalem, and Kuwait, and I love your region, and it pains me to see what's going on now. One of the things many of you brought up was the need for a pluralistic dialogue, the need to have the kind of self-criticism and discussion that we had yesterday here on July 4th. And one thing that I saw last summer when I was in Indonesia was some of that dialogue going on, that they have their own problems in Indonesia, but there is a real dialogue between moderates, between different Muslim groups, between people really fighting out what their faith means to them and what that translates into in the political world. And what I'm wondering is, this is not a discussion that can be led by America. It's not our place, and it won't be successful. But it is a discussion that could be led by other Muslim countries with the non-Arab Muslim countries to bring out your moderates, to bring out the discussion lines that need to happen so that you can heal your own countries and your own political processes. And all we can do is support and help, but that needs to come from you. And I'm wondering if there's any appetite for that in the region to build out that moderate political process and that moderate dialogue space.
Thank you. Next, please.
My name is Vic Weinstein, and thanks to the present administration, I'm a Republican evolving into a Democrat.
But we're running out of time.
I'd like to address my question to Queen Noor. I read your book actually a couple of years ago and got a different perspective and enjoyed it. Knowing, you know, a little of your history, I always thought that I'm sure your goals are the same as many of us to see this world a better place, that maybe you could be more effective if you went back into the American political process. Did you ever think of that? And I have one more comment. I want to thank you for being so nice to my family on the bus yesterday.
Okay. Next, please.
Yeah, my name is Todd Boucher. I'm a Bezos scholar from Biloxi, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. You talked a lot about the children or the youth and the age of the Middle East, that there's a very large proportion of younger people there. And this is an ideas festival, and some of us teachers were talking about the fact, why don't they create some kind of teacher exchange program? Because teachers have 3 months out of the year where they're totally free. And that would be a great opportunity for teachers from America to go over there and start bridging this gap that we're talking about, this mutual respect, where we could interact with maybe teachers from the area and then maybe bring some of those teachers back here so we could learn the cultures, and then we would directly influence the youth of not just the Middle Eastern region but even the American children. And again, it was just an idea.
Well, that's what this meeting is all about, ideas. Thank you.
Varuki, I too am a proud member of the Middle East Strategy Group, but also a frustrated one. I'm frustrated in that I actually made a trip to Gaza right after the withdrawal, and the intent was to actually invest in the territory in order to create jobs. I'd like to direct a question to Secretary Albright and to Ambassador Ayalon. The fact is that criteria for investment are not there. That is reality. What can be done to actually encourage business people to come and invest in order to create jobs, in order to create stakeholders for peace? And what can Israel do about this, Mr. Ambassador? Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we have some questions directed specifically at Queen Noor, Madeline, and Dan. So let me ask you, Nabil, on intra-Muslim dialogue. How do you think that ought to go, the question about why isn't there more of it, shouldn't there be more of it, and so on?
Well, let me say the following. I mean, if one can come here and say that we're ready to learn from America and its experiences, then it goes without saying that any experience around the world that is practical, we'd be happy to listen to. It's interesting that a number of years ago, the Islamic Conference, it was, I think, the last speech given by the former Prime Minister of Malaysia, and he called for a serious inter-Muslim dialogue about how to move forward. He was very self-critical, not in a way of trying to be to condemn anybody, but in a way of trying to move the process forward. So it's a good idea, but I just want to make a point here. At the end of the day, this is a process. People have the most important part of it, in my mind, is to get people to engage. And to get them to engage, I agree with Secretary Albright, they have to at least have the basic economic sustenance to aspire to participate. And it's going to take time. But I think your idea is a good one. I just don't think it's the answer. It's one of the ways we can move things forward. And it does carry with it a sense of neutrality that maybe the coming from a superpower, east or west in the past, is more sensitive than that. So that's an important point.
Well, Queen Noor, a question from the faltering Republican. Do you want to run for president?
I have heard so many times, even in Congress and elsewhere, I've been very complimented by those who recognize that my heart is so much in this country, and this country is so much a part of my heart and all the priorities that I've set for myself over my entire life, including those that matched and resonated so well with my husband when we first met and led to our... And my heart is also in the Middle East. Jordan, of course, has the most special place, but also I feel a part of the struggle and the aspirations of everyone in our region. And I see how similar those are to the struggles and the aspirations and the dreams of the people I grew up with in this country and that I am able to interact with, you know, or have ever since. So I feel that my responsibility for the rest of my life is to continue to serve as a bridge between our cultures, to work in both, to try to promote better understanding, common ground, and hope, a sense of hope and possibility for the future. And I do that through the King Hussein Foundation and in my individual, you know, efforts to, with groups and organizations on the ground, the grassroots, and at the highest levels of government.
Thanks. Kareem, teacher exchange. What's your thought about that?
Well, we have seen a lot of exchanges take place, maybe in smaller groups that come here for a week or two. And I make it a point to meet with them before they start their tour in the United States and after. And frankly, they all leave with a very positive impression. They come with inhibitions about the United States because, unfortunately, also the media in our region carries probably a one-sided view as well. Just as some of the media here in the U.S. Don't show.
You couldn't resist saying that.
Had to. But certainly it is very helpful, and teachers and students in particular hold the promise for the future. If I may expand, because also some of those exchange groups involved some of our judges from the Sharia courts, but also representatives of the clergy. And this is an important issue that Congresswoman Harman touched on. We have realized in Jordan and His Majesty King Abdullah, watching like the rest of us beheadings in Iraq and the Beslan school in Russia, he said we can no longer just observe those issues and condemn them. It's high time that we act against them. And this is what started the Amman message of saying we want to return to traditional Islam. One that continues the Abrahamic tradition in Judaism and Christianity, one that respects other faiths. And I, as a representative of the small Christian minority in Jordan, can attest to the model that Jordan presents, not just tolerance, but moving to acceptance and mutual respect. And certainly what we are trying to do is to find that centrist movement, which is quite large in the Muslim world. And unfortunately, we hear but of few radical extremists that have tainted such a negative image about a peaceful religion that has contributed to our civilization. And this is where the efforts have been over the past year and a half to start with the heads of state and ministers of religious affairs, but going to the clergy to make sure that their sermons are in line with the Amman message of peace and acceptance, and moving to the third level of working with the teachers and the to make sure that the curriculum is in line with the true teachings of Islam and not what those extremists have been preaching. And finally, it's going out to the general public to make sure that everybody knows. But the message is that the moderate Muslims should be supported because this challenge is within Islam, as we have seen. Zarqawi, who was one of the most notorious terrorists in Iraq, who was killed 3 weeks ago, he was of Jordanian origin, but he is not a product of Jordan, he is a product of Afghanistan. But what we have seen in Jordan is that many people, unfortunately, supported suicide bombings as long as they were happening in Israel or in Iraq, and they tried to justify the cause. But after the horrible attacks on Amman on the 9th of November, which is our 9/11, we have seen this 180-degree shift in public opinion that no longer people would accept suicide bombings or the indiscriminate targeting of innocent civilians, and regardless of the cause. And hopefully this is what will help uproot terrorism from our region. And I have to say here that terrorism has taken the biggest toll on Arabs and Muslims who have been the largest victims of terrorism, and this is something that hopefully we can cooperate and deal with. Thank you.
All right, we are way over time, but we do have one last question about how to encourage investment. It was addressed to you, Dan, and to you, Madeline. So, ladies first.
Well, let me say that when I was secretary, I really appreciated the relationship between business and our government. Who would have ever thought? And I think that it is a very important relationship. I now, and I would like to see, and at that stage I was most, we were talking about the former communist countries, about getting businesses to invest there. And I had, there's one view when you are a policymaker that you want businesses to go in because it spreads the word and various creates a whole set of relationships. I now have a business myself, and so I do know that you need to worry about the bottom line. Businesses are not philanthropic organizations. So it is a difficult issue in terms of trying to persuade people to go into Gaza, for instance, at a time when there is a great deal of violence. What I do wish had happened, and I would hope that it would create a climate, is that I wish the Palestinian business people had gone to Hamas and said, you are not helping in terms of the long run, that it would have helped if they had said it would help if you gave up violence as a tactic. I didn't see that happening. And I would have wished that the Israeli businessmen had gone to the Israeli government and said, open up the crossings, because how can there possibly be a functioning economy in Gaza that is not allowed to get out? And I wish that the regional people would have said, export our things through Port Said. Or some way that people would have understood that the business in the area was not just about making money. The business was in order to create an infrastructure to give jobs to the young people, and if the business people want to be a part of it, they have to also be involved in the political process and work to try to get a climate that works. And the U.S., with the OPIC guarantees, I think we did a lot, or are trying to do a lot. So it's that combination.
Very quickly, Dan and Nabil wants a very quick comment.
I would first of all, I would second what Secretary Albright said, except that if the Palestinian leadership came to Hamas to say stop the terrorism, then Israelis wouldn't need to take any measures. So I think this is the root cause. If there was no terrorism, there wouldn't be any problem of passages or opening or movement of people or products. Now, I would say specifically to the question that was asked here by Mr. Farouki, and thank you for that, is that we need three things. First of all, we need the rule of law. We need transparency with the investment, the accounting, and the business activities. And for all of that, we need, of course, political stability. And without this, no private businessman would come. Israelis businessmen invested millions of dollars on the Palestinians during the good years from 93 and on. But in 2000, in one day, all those major projects were burned down by Palestinian terrorists. This doesn't bode well for welcoming investments in the future. So what we need, basically, is political stability, end of terror, and also good governance. And this is specifically why the roadmap to peace, which was universally accepted and was underwritten by the quartet, called in the first phase for a economical reform in the Palestinian Authority and a political reform so you can really attract business. And really, it is a shame. After Israel left Gaza, and we left Gaza intact with all the infrastructure, including with all the nursing facilities, the greenhouses, that it wasn't kept up. On the contrary, terrorism took it and tore it down. And this is a major problem that we have. Jimmy Wolfenson did a great job by mobilizing pledges of $9 billion. Where is the money? The Palestinians are not receiving it. They should enforce law and order. They should enforce good governance, good transparency, and then the money will come.
Okay, last word, Nabil.
We also...
Okay, next to the last word, Nabil, you'll get the last word.
He also said that you can't have a million starving Palestinians and have peace.
Absolutely. That's why we keep everything open, and we have all the humanitarian aid
I'm
possible.
I'm out, guys. We're running late. I promise Nabil the last word.
Well, two quick points. Congressman Harman asked why I didn't mention terrorism in my presentation, given particularly that we had been the target of terrorism very early. Frankly, I've just been tired of talking about it all the time, so I decided to let somebody else raise it. But seriously, terrorism against Arabs, Muslims, against Israelis is unacceptable, and we need to work on that. On two counts,
the security issue and, again, on the economic issue, because you're not going to convince the terrorist to be a Democrat, but you can pull away the possible support he can get in the process. On the economic issue, two quick suggestions. It's all about risk. And if we can put together a fund, a grant to basically share the risk for investors, to guarantee risks at investors, that would help in putting together some small projects. It's not going to end up creating a major project. But we need to be able to share in the risk, and I agree with you, from the region and outside the region, not only from outside the region. My last proposal, again on the youth, one of the problems with the youth in the Middle East, they don't have the assets to invest in new projects. And many of the areas that they're working on are areas that are not traditionally financed by banks in the region because you can't mortgage them. So I, again, would urge you to look at seriously how we can put together new models for